Looking at what my prepared notes are, do you have anything further to say on that, Jim? You have any cleanups, right?
I got to say, I love Jack, and Jack is one of my best buds, and you know, so that's all, Jack. He sent me a note a couple days ago, saying, take a look at my lawn. It looks so damn good.
I sent him a picture of my lawn. He sent me down. He's a dandelion killer too, but that's another story. But I was getting ready to solo him in my T6 to send it down to Maryville with him, and down to Columbus, Ohio with him, and we flew over this gorgeous cross runway grass field that was just eaten up with dandelions. He couldn't wait to get on the ground and try to have a conversation with the guy that owned it to see if he'd let him kill those dandelions. He sent tanker loads of liquid dandelion fertilizer to...
We sent a whole truckload of Turf Builder Plus 2 to, like, deal with that.
So if you have a grass strip and you let Jim Hagedorn fly over, you may just have a dandelion program waiting for you.
Okay. Ray, did you have something you wanted to defend yourself or somebody?
It is funny whenever Jack talks about the people, kind of reel them in and reel stuff in. However, both of these guys, if you've seen the pictures of the P-51s flying in the contrails in the 35,000, a lot of people don't know the P-51 is certified to 41,000 feet and actually holds a record right now with another guy that went to 43,000 feet. But Jack went up just to get pictures in the contrails, which is pretty spectacular picture. But then some other guy came up with an idea about flying the P-51 across the North Atlantic for the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And fortunately, Jack was stabbing his voodoo doll for that one, and everything actually was working against us for that trip. But these guys do so much, so much for aviation, and just to bring the airplanes to the public. And
I was thinking about that today, Ray, when I was flying across the lake, was what happens if I go down? That one, we had exposure suits on, survival vests on. You had to carry a vest or a raft in your lap. It was going to be quite a trip.
Yeah, we don't recommend flying over the Lake Michigan unless you're less than 23,000 feet at the peak of it, or center of it, in which case you could coast to land or drift.
And you remember what you told me, right, about if you had to go get your airplane, what you'd rather use?
Yeah, I'd rather use a rowback to pick it up rather than something to get it out of the water. Rather than a crane to get out of the water.
So I will add, Ray and I are fortunate to fly these airplanes, and when we fly Jack's airplane and he says, don't fly across the lake, we go around.
And Jim went around this morning, so he is trainable.
That was because of the thunderstorms, dude.
It's all price to pay. The fact that there is a P-51 Mustang for us to celebrate today was really an unlikely result of what was going on at the beginning of World War II. In April of 1940, the British Air Commission, Purchasing Commission, came over to negotiate a contract between North American Aviation, who was making B-25s and T-6s that were high quality and good value to the governments that had them. And they wanted North American to accept a license to join an agreement with Curtiss to produce a P-40. And the North American people figured that the P-40 was already obsolete. Except for the things that they did with it in China, with the dive through the formations, you couldn't turn with a Zero or with a number of the other Japanese airplanes with a P-40, and that's what they were faced with. As the things got hot in Europe, that's what they were going to face over there as well with the ME-109. So Edgar Schumann was actually born in Germany. Was the chief design engineer at the North American, and he'd been investigating something called the laminar flow wing that the Russians and the Japanese had written some papers about. And he also had an idea that it needed to be a V-12 cross section, need to have the radiator scoop as far aft as it could, so that it would not generate more drag than necessary. And they actually configured the radiator, which is the scoop on the bottom of the airplanes, so that the inlet and exhaust generated were so configured they generated thrust. And the claim was made that the amount of thrust they generated offset the drag that they put on the airplane. I've not flown a Mustang without a scoop, so I can't swear that I have that impression. But the wing design was it was coordinated with the research group of government people, the NACA, and it was reportedly 50% less drag than a conventional wing like the other wider fighters had. They were going to use flush rivets throughout, and they made an agreement to produce a flying prototype in 120 days of this new design. And For that accommodation, the Purchasing Commission that granted a issued a purchase order for how many was it for about 400 airplanes, and then 102 days versus 120, the airframe was finished, and the government was in control of the engine supply, the V6, the V12, 60-degree V12 Allison engine, and also the guns and the brakes, and they held the U.S. Army military or aviation establishment held back on prioritizing an Allison engine away from the production for the P-40 and for the P-38s. They took 18 days to get them an engine. The airplane was encouraging. It could do about what the Spitfire could do, maybe a little better at low altitude, certainly not a lot better. It carried more fuel and so had more endurance, which came into play later. And the other thing that was going on is that not only did they need airframes, they needed to have an engine, 60-degree V12 engine that would that they could use in their Spitfires and in their other military airplanes that the British was using the engine in. But looking at the Merlin, which they eventually issued a license to Packard Motor Car Company, was building cars in August of 1940. The engine had 14,000 parts, which an automobile for the day had about 7,000 parts, and it weighed 1,700 pounds. Looking at the factory that built the engines, they burned 80,000 gallons of gasoline a day in testing. They prepared the engines for service in Europe with an initial six-hour break-in, which we do in our rebuild operation today. They disassembled it and checked critical things, and they put 5 hours more on it before they put it in a box and sent it to the Europe. So it had 11 hours. I don't think anybody ever took a Merlin engine out of a can and put it in service and had trouble with it. They were trouble-free. But the Army Air Corps had the Pratt & Whitney 2800s that they used in the Corsair that they planned to put in other airplanes, which they did only in the Hellcat and in the Thunderbolt. So they were pretty happy with those airplanes, and if they needed more endurance, more distance, they had the P-38, which had two of the more efficient Allison 17-10 cubic inch V-12s. Looking at the airplane, let me talk one more thing about the engines. From 1939 to 1956, there were 170,000 so-called Merlin engines built that were put in military service or used for air freighting operations after the war. The 3 years from 1943 to 1945, under this license, the Packard Motor Car Company built 85,000 engines, which was half of what the was produced for the type over 16 years. Looking at the airplane that they put the engine in, there was it was 7,400 pounds dry. It was average loaded for combat was 11,500 pounds. There were less than 4,000 of the B's and the C's that the green airplane is a B. The B model airplanes were built in Anaheim, California, and the C's were built in Dallas, Texas. There were 15,874 airplanes built. To put that into context, there was 20,351 Spitfires, 30,480 ME-109s, and 36,000 Russian Stormoveks. So at 15,800 airplanes, that's less than, it's less than 2% of the 276,000 U.S. manufactured airplanes that served in the war. Just add a sobering thought at the end of it. From Pearl Harbor until the Japanese surrendered in August of 1945, there were 170 aircraft lost for every day of that time frame. And there were 220,000 U.S. airmen that lost their lives as well. Who's going to read the...
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to point out that the Gentleman Jim airplane, I spoke of the old Crow aircraft, but I'd like to give you a little background on the Gentleman Jim. That airplane Jack named for Bud's best friend who was killed in World War II, so he's one of these casualties that you would speak of. He was from Kansas. Again, his one of Bud's best friends, and Jim named his son, or Bud named his son Jim, after Jim Browning, who was Gentleman Jim aircraft pilot in World War II. And Jack, I want to say thank you not only for being here, but for maintaining these airplanes and for what you do for the entire Warbird community with your research and development and your aircraft engines. So, yes, very appropriate.
It's been my pleasure.